From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, and our show today is about llamas. You know, the animal, the cousin, I guess, of the camel. And why? Well, a couple of reasons. First, the latest film in our documentary series is a local film about llamas, or anyway, the people who love them and raise them and show them. There's a circuit of llama shows, and they're kind of competitive. But here's the other reason. Llamas are kind of amazing. They have a fascinating history. As one of our guests explains it, they've been hunted and worshipped. At times they were seen as sacred. They've been national symbols. And yes, they spit sometimes. But shouldn't there be at least one radio show somewhere about the llama? So stay with us. It's a lot more interesting than you think. After the news.
We want to take a moment to shout out The Good Line for supporting this podcast. If you're building a brand, these guys can help you with websites, film, design. They're all about finding and telling stories that bring together a full brand experience. Check out the new Radio West Films website to find out what that means, or you can see what else they do at thegoodline.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're continuing our documentary series with a local film about llamas. The director of the film grew up with these creatures. In fact, his father is a character in the film. He's charming, a little eccentric, but passionate about llamas. And those who love them have their reasons. You may come to understand it better once you hear, well, the story of the llama. We'll get to the film in a moment, but we're going to begin with a llama scholar, a llama historian. There is one at the University of York in England. She's a senior lecturer in modern history there, and she has a book called Llama. Her name is Helen Cowie. She joined us recently from the studios of the BBC in Devon, UK, and she began with the story of the first llama to appear in Europe.
Probably the first llama to actually reach Europe arrives in the Dutch city of Middelburg in 1558. And it's actually then presented to the Holy Roman Emperor, Ferdinand I, as a gift, which was very common in those days. The most exotic animals, particularly from the New World, were often gifted to members of the royal family, like Ferdinand. And it really creates a lot of interest because no one has seen an animal like this before. There are no references to animals like llamas in the Bible. They have to find new ways of describing it and understanding it.
What did they make of them? Someone described it as a most gentle and meek beast. Mm.
Yes, this llama seems to have behaved itself on this occasion. there's no reference to it spitting or causing any difficulty because, as I discuss later in the book, llamas do have a bit of a reputation for being stubborn and being difficult. Yeah. But this one appears to have behaved quite amicably. I think people had various reactions to llamas, both in Europe, but also in America itself, where the first Spanish settlers and conquistadors came into contact with them. One of the things you see in particular is how they try to make sense of these animals and the descriptions that they come up with for them. And usually they go for reference points that they already know about. So they compare the animals to animals from the old world. Mm-hmm. So in the case of the llama, you tend to get them comparing it to the camel, to which it is distantly related, and also the sheep. So they tend to call them Peruvian sheep is the most common term because alpacas in particular are very woolly.
Explain your own interest in this. You write about how you spent a good amount of time stalking llamas and tracking them and going around watching shows. What's your interest in them?
My own interest actually generated from a historical perspective. As part of an earlier project I was working on, looking at the history of zoos and travelling animal shows, I ended up coming upon a digitised article from the 19th century about an attempt to smuggle llamas out of Peru and to bring them to Britain and to Australia. And this triggered a broader interest that I already have in South American history and particularly South American fauna.
Yeah. You say you've come to greatly admire them.
I do greatly admire them, yes. I think that they're very spirited animals. One writer, Flora Tristan, writing in the 19th century, commented that one of the really good things about llamas is that they only accept life on condition that it be sweet. So they don't let people boss them around. And I really admire that in an animal.
Where do they fit in the let's get technical for a minute. In the species category, the taxonomy, where do they fit, llamas?
So llamas are, as I've said, they're distantly related to camels. Yeah. They come from an ancestor, Procamelus, which was initially in North America rather than South America.
Right.
And this is thought to have originated about 40 or 50 million years BC. These animals then, about 3 million years ago, crossed a land bridge that opened up between North and what's now South America. Mm. And the llama evolved from there, while the camels obviously crossed the Bering Strait and ended up evolving into camels, two species of camels in Asia and Africa.
Do they exist in the wild anymore, or have they mostly become domesticated?
So technically, llamas, all llamas, are domesticated animals. Llamas are domesticated guanacos. So the guanaco is the wild llama from which we think indigenous people in South America derived the llama by domesticating it. So llamas per se don't exist in the wild, but there are wild ancestors or guanacos still out there.
What do we know about the history of that domestication? You say in the book people in South America started to domesticate them, 6,000 or 7,000 years ago?
Yeah. So quite a long time ago. And these would have been various indigenous civilizations in different parts of Peru. We don't know exactly how or when it happened, as is true of the domestication of many species. But we do have archaeological evidence from, for example, various caves in Peru, where you find the bones of what look like domesticated species, as opposed to llamas that had just been hunted or guanacos that had been hunted. And you find various archaeological remains or figurines and various other art artifacts representing llamas in archaeological sites in Peru, places like Chan Chan in the north of Peru, which was important for the Chimú culture.
I have to say the pooping part was kind of interesting. they poop in these community areas.
They do. Llamas are very clean, actually. Yeah. For this reason, they're very popular, both as farm animals, but also they're in fact used as golf caddies. And this is partly because they don't just poop anywhere. Yeah. They'll poop all in one place in a field in what is called a community dung pile, which I think is a rather fabulous term.
Absolutely.
So they are in fact very clean animals. And I have actually seen this with llamas that I've watched myself in Britain mainly. They do this. They've got a particular area that they use and the rest of their field will be particularly clean. And that was also important, actually, and still is important for indigenous people in Peru, who in fact use llama excrement as a kind of fuel. And it was even used in things like silver mining and copper smelting into the 19th century, because you don't have many trees high in the Andes, so you don't have much other fuel. So the llamas actually, as well as all the other things they provide for human beings, their waste was even useful, which I thought was quite fantastic.
Yeah. The spitting, of course, they're notorious for that. But this was really interesting. It turns out, you're right, they produce three types of spit.
Yeah, that's true. So we tend to just sort of lump it all together and think of one generic spitting action. But actually, they have three levels of spitting. So if a llama is just mildly annoyed with you, it will do what's called an air spit.
Yeah.
And this is effectively just making a spitting motion, but not really ejecting anything. If it's even more cross, it will do what's called a full mouth spit, which is basically spitting at you with its saliva, which is unpleasant, but not too bad. But if it's really cross, then it will do what's called a true spit. And this is what we really talk about when we refer to llamas spitting. And in this case, it will regurgitate some of its food. The llamas have three stomachs, so it can kind of regurgitate the stuff from the first one, and it will spit at you in that way. But one interesting thing is that llamas themselves don't really like to do this, because although the spit will get on you and it'll smell really bad, the llama itself gets the spit in its mouth and it has to sort of stand there airing its mouth for about half an hour for the smell to clear. So only in desperate circumstances will they do the true spit.
Of course, they're quite connected to Incan culture. Explain a bit, in what way did they contribute to the success of that culture? Because you described they were crucial to it.
Yeah, I'd argue that they were essential, really. One thing we need to remember about the Incas, and indeed all indigenous people in South America, is that they didn't have the kind of domestic animals that we had back in Europe in the sort of pre the Spanish conquest. So they didn't have cows, they didn't have sheep, they didn't have pigs, they didn't have horses. So the llama essentially was the only really large and significant domesticated animal they had. They also domesticate guinea pigs, but they were mainly for food. Yeah. So the llama had to serve all the functions of cows, sheep, pigs. So on the one hand, they were a beast of burden. They could be used to transport food, things like maize and potatoes between the coast and the highlands. They were also really important as a source of wool, particularly the llama's smaller relative, the alpaca. And they were actually eaten as well. So llama meat was produced. It was often dried to form something called charqui, which is where we get the term beef jerky from, obviously for beef dried. So llamas basically did pretty much everything for the Incas, and they probably couldn't have achieved the things they did, expanded their empire in the way they did without that.
Llamas played an important role in Indian mythology, helped them explain their place in the universe. Say something about that.
Yeah, so because llamas were so essential to the way in which the Incas lived, it's not surprising perhaps that both they and other indigenous groups assigned them a kind of ritual importance as well. Every day they would sacrifice a white llama to the sun god Inti as a way of thanking the gods for giving them this valuable animal. And they also would actually assign the name of different llamas to constellations. So it was an important part of Inca astronomy as well. There was one llama called Yacana, and it was believed that this celestial llama would effectively drink all the water from the oceans to prevent them from flooding the lands. And it would do that every night, and that would keep the lands from flooding. There's also quite an interesting story relating to effectively the idea of the Great Flood.
Yeah. And this is my favorite one, by the way. I love this story.
Right.
Keep going.
It's quite a good story. So, I mean, in the Incan version of effectively the Noah's Ark story, there's an individual, an Incan peasant, who he's trying to make his llama go where it doesn't want to go. And the llama's insisting on going to high ground because it apparently knows that a flood is about to occur. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, it refuses to do what he wants to do, which is a big thing in llama history generally. And it insists on going to this point of higher ground. And then the floods come in, and obviously the man and the llama survive, and then they repopulate the earth from there. So I guess the important thing is that, you know, there are many different versions of this story in different cultures and religions, but for the Incas, the llama played a pivotal role. And it's not surprising because it was a pivotal animal for them.
The part of that story I love too is that the llama was sad, didn't want to go either.
Yeah.
And at some point he'd become so exasperated with his human owner that he speaks and says, "Look, you idiot, a flood is coming," or something like that.
Absolutely, yes. And I think llamas becoming exasperated is probably a recurring theme in the book. But but yes, it's quite interesting to see the character of the animal actually coming through, because you can certainly imagine many a llama refusing to do various things. And in this case, it's given these kind of mythological importance.
They played a mediating role, you say, between people and the gods in Incan culture.
Absolutely, yes. So on the one hand, the gods needed to be pacified so that the flocks could actually increase. A lot of the rituals that were performed were designed to ensure the fertility of the flocks, to make sure that they survived. But at the same time, because these were animals that the Incas had reared, put their energy into, then they were a worthy sacrifice to the gods. That it was something they could present the gods as a way of thanking them.
One of the elements of, superstition that was interesting about this is that they used llama cadavers to help predict the future.
Yes, they did. This particularly would happen after you'd sacrificed a llama. So typically this would mean taking the llama to a sort of central sort of temple, and you'd slit its throat as a way of killing it. All a bit grisly. But after that, the sort of local shaman would try to remove the animal's heart and lungs while it was still sort of semi-living. And he would look at them. If they were still palpitating, that was a good sign. That meant the crops would succeed the next year, or would be well. If not, things might not go so well. So there was a lot of superstition surrounding that. And there were similar rituals as well in times of drought, where they would sometimes basically put a llama and refuse to feed it and tie it up. And its kind of squeals and groans, it was thought, would induce the pity of the gods. So they'd cause it to rain.
Wow.
So that all these kind of rituals factor into Inca culture.
Let's talk about what happened to llamas as the result of the Spanish conquest of the New World. You were referring to this earlier. In the book, you describe it as this collision between two human worlds and two distinct ecosystems. Talk a little bit about what happens. I mean, this was kind of the tragic part of the story in some ways.
Yes, this is definitely the saddest century for the llama, I would say. And of course, also for the indigenous people of the Americas.
Of course, yeah.
So essentially, when the Spanish arrive, they've already conquered the Aztecs in Mexico. And in 1532, they succeed in ousting the Incas civilization in Peru. Part of the consequence of that is that many llamas are in fact killed simply for meat. And all the careful planning that the Incas had invested in them, that stops. Mm-hmm. Many Incas, of course, themselves are killed, many indigenous people, some from disease, some from warfare, and they're no longer able to tend their flocks. The other thing that happens is that, of course, the Spanish bring their own livestock over to the Americas from Europe. So you do start to get the first sheep, the first cattle, and the first horses in the Americas. Partly this means for the Spanish that llamas are less important than they had been because they have their own beasts of burden. But it also means that you get new competition for llamas who to some extent now have to be outcompeted by sheep for grass and the things that they needed to eat. But more seriously, these animals often bring diseases over from the old world. We don't know precisely what these diseases were, but it looks like it may have been some form of mange. And this kills a large number of llamas and alpacas. And I mean a large number. We're talking in the century after the conquest of a drop in numbers of about 80 to 90%, which is really substantial. I mean, I should say that the human population suffers a similar drop according to some calculations. So essentially, the llama suffers the same fate as the Incas do, which is an extremely sad time.
Yeah. You were talking earlier about how when Europeans came here, they had to figure out where these strange creatures fit within their system of classification. I mean, they had to basically really revise some of their thinking. Say something about that.
Absolutely. And this is one of the things that several historians have pointed out. The New World is completely new. The Spanish are faced with all these different animals that they don't have any reference for, either in the Bible or in the writing of classical scholars. They don't have anything that they can actually read and sort of grasp onto. And they're faced with some really strange animals. So as well as the llama, you have creatures like anteaters. There's nothing much like an anteater in the old world.
Yeah.
Creatures like sloths as well, armadillos. All of these pose a real challenge in terms of how you go about describing them. And as I've said, what tends to happen is you get these kind of jigsaw puzzle descriptions that say it's got the head of this old world animal, it's got the body of this one, its tail's a bit like this one, its colour's a bit like this. And you also get some rather strange pictures emerging as a result of that, particularly from artists who don't go to America, but are just relying on these verbal descriptions by people on the ground.
It raised philosophical questions, you say. They had to this is how you put it in the book, they had to recalibrate their understanding of the natural world.
They did have to seriously rethink how it was that there was this whole continent with this whole range of fauna that did not have any mention in the Bible. And among scholars, this particularly manifested itself in big queries about, well, were there alpacas on Noah's Ark, for example? Were there llamas? How did they come to be there? How had they survived the flood?
Yeah.
Because obviously we've seen that this is part of Inca mythology. It was also key to Spanish mythology too, but in a different way. So you find different ways of wrestling with this and attempting to explain it. But it certainly forced the Spanish to rethink some of their broader ideas about how the world had come to be effectively and how the animals were where they were.
You write about the llamas and bringing them to Europe. What's the story of North America and where they first emerged in the American West? What's that story?
This seems to have been mainly in the 19th century that animals start to be brought both to Europe and also to North America. So there's a case of a llama that I know of being brought to New York in the 1840s from Peru. It had gone across the isthmus at Panama and been shipped up that way. And there were several llamas and alpacas in that group, some of which were actually then purchased at auction and later shipped to London and later shipped down to Australia. And towards the end of the 19th century, you do also start to see some alpacas in particular, because people really valued them for their wool, being introduced, as you said, to the American West, particularly sort of states like California, which were very interested in bringing in all kinds of new animals. Ostriches were another one that they were particularly interested in at that point. So it's kind of a parallel, but it starts off in Europe because that's where they first start to manufacture alpaca wool on an industrial scale.
In the documentary, it's called Llama Nation. There's a woman who talks about when she and her husband were first interested in raising llamas. I think this was 10, 20 years ago. At that time, they were tens of thousands of dollars. So this interest in llamas these days, I don't think it's really new. It seems like, as you write about in the book, it's kind of just an emergence, a reemergence of this interest, maybe. Is that how you explain the interest in llamas today in the United States?
I think that certainly makes sense. I think it's been a cyclical thing. I mean, one thing to say is that Peru actually wasn't too keen on its llamas and alpacas being exported. And in the 19th century, they were very touchy about alpacas in particular being sent abroad, because this was damaging to their own wool industry. So they do actually impose a ban from 1845, which means that you can't legally export these animals. So although people desired them, it was difficult physically to get hold of them. And also practically, it was difficult to transport them such long distances and to have them survive. But I think certainly, probably since sort of the 1980s, it's been become easier. The bans have been relaxed, and it's obviously easier to transport creatures a longer distance. So I think there's been a long-standing interest in these creatures. They appear in zoos and places like that throughout this period. But by that point, there's a possibility of actually getting hold of them. But yes, I think, I mean, certainly here in Britain, llamas and in particular alpacas are becoming increasingly popular, I would say, over the last decade. I certainly see quite a few around these days. Often, I have to say, as a kind of hobby farm animal, there are some attempts to seriously breed them on a large scale for their wool, sometimes for their meat. But in Britain, at least, and I don't know if it's the same in the States, it's often people having a small flock, sometimes to do things like guarding lambs, which they're quite good at, but also just for pets, effectively, to have a more exotic animal around. And they certainly have the cute factor for that.
Well, I think that's it. I mean, I think that's what the documentary is about in some ways. And one of the kind of principal focuses of the film is these judging competitions, which you've seen a few of these. What did you make of that?
The ones I saw were actually in Exeter in the southwest of the UK, and they were primarily alpacas. It was really interesting to watch. So the alpacas are classed according to age and also according to their colour. That's the typical way that they judge them. And it's all about assessing, firstly, their kind of bodily composition, so how they walk, their gait, looking and checking their teeth are good. But it's mainly about their fleeces. And they can check the kind of crimp of the fleece, how soft it is, how thick it is. And they're awarded points based upon that. You also get slightly more, I guess, fun competitions. Last year, I did actually watch an alpaca obstacle race at the Devon County Show. I think it's fair to say alpacas don't much like going over obstacles. But this is more of a training competition. And you get things like llamas in fancy dress as well. So there's a few different things people do. But the more serious side of it is to do with breeding, and it's to do with producing the best quality fleece.
Well, you write in the book about how the llamas over time have been hunted and worshipped and farmed and petted. I mean, they've competed in shows. They've become therapy animals. What's the future, finally, do you think?
I think for the llama itself, the future is probably quite bright. They are expanding. There's a big llama diaspora beyond Peru. In Peru itself, they're also incredibly important culturally, very popular. You certainly see a lot of them if you go to Peru as a tourist, but they also do continue to play a very serious role in Peruvian culture. And the alpaca, too, very much as a major export for Peru in terms of its wool. So I think that's going to continue. Efforts are going to be made to improve the creatures genetically. And I think the popularity will go on. Llamas themselves are probably not under any particular threat in terms of conservation, but that's probably not true of some of their wild relatives. So the guanaco is hunted and has some threats in terms of its territory. And the wild alpaca, the vicuña, it was hunted for its fleece for hundreds of years, and it really was in serious trouble by the 1960s. It's revived somewhat, but it will continue to face threats from poaching. So I think the future for the wilder relatives of the llama is probably more questionable. But for the llama itself, I think a bright future filled with fancy dress parades, probably.
Matellan Cowie. She's a senior lecturer in modern history at the University of York in England. Her book is called Llama. She joined us from the studios of the BBC in Devon, England. Don't forget, we're showing the film Llama Nation next Thursday night, April 5th, at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. This is part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. The filmmakers Aaron Alsop and Tanner Shinnick will be there for a Q&A. There may be, I don't want to promise this quite yet, but there may even be a llama or two at the event. We're still working on it. We'll have more details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll have a conversation with Aaron Alsop and Tanner Shinnick when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we continue our documentary series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center, with a film about llamas. On Thursday, we're screening the film Llama Nation. As we've heard, they have a fascinating story, these creatures, domesticated by the ancient Incans. They've been sacred totems and livestock. They've been pets and therapy animals. And, of course, they compete in shows. As you'll see, if you come to the film on Thursday, it's kind of competitive. We spoke with the filmmakers, Tanner Shinnick, who directed the film, and Aaron Alsop, who was an executive producer. We began with Tanner, who grew up with llamas. And as he explained, making a film about them just made sense.
It's one of those weird things where it almost felt like something I was destined to do. I grew up showing llamas. I was terrible at it. Like, I think best I ever did was eighth place. Wow. Then, you know, I hung up my boots and moved on. But no, it was just something that was always in the back of my mind because I just remembered all these unique characters from my childhood. And just like that story was never out there, like no one knew about it. So like it kind of just started from there, going through film school and everything. Like it was always in the back of my head. Well, we were always, Aaron and another friend of ours, John, we were always, you know, pitching around different movie ideas and things that we wanted to do. And one day we all decided just to get together and pitch all of our ideas. And the llama idea came up to do a feature-length documentary about that. And we all just sat around the table like, all right, yeah, cool. That sounds good. Let's do that. And that's really how it started right there. I think we were actually at Leatherby's in Taylorsville sitting around the table.
One of the main characters in the film is Tracy Pearson. Tanner, describe her.
Oh, man.
She's great. You explain her in the film as the godmother of Llama Nation, I guess.
She is absolutely one of my favorite humans. She is just one of the most caring and passionate people that I have ever met, even outside of llamas. I remember because my relationship to her is my dad's known her for years. And I just remember being a child, like, you know, 8, 9 years old and going up and visiting their ranch and just being treated like a king. And that's how they treat everybody. I mean, they're just very good, down to earth people.
She's married to Jack, and in the film they talk about how they came to llamas. They had bought some land, and as Jack says it in this moment from the film, Tracy comes up with this idea to raise llamas, and Jack says, "No one raises llamas," and Tracy says, "Well, that's the reason to do it." Here's a moment from the film.
We built our home after we built our barn. First things first, we finally tracked down where to buy a llama. We bought one llama. Back then, we paid $100,000 for him.
What justified paying that amount?
Insanity. Nobody knew anything about llamas, so this was an experiment from day one. Okay, where's the common sense?
What are they like? And I want to ask both of you that question because I'm guessing you both have different kinds of reactions. I'm actually interested in Aaron's reaction first. What are llamas like, the llamas that you came to? Like, how do you describe them? Because I'm sure Tanner is going to have a different kind of answer. But like, what are they like? Because people who don't know anything about llamas are going to have a perception. And there's this basic misconception that comes up, which we'll get to in a second here. But what are they? How do you describe llamas?
To me, llamas are like, they're kind of like the Chris Farley of animals.
That's good.
In the sense that,
that's good.
You know, Chris Farley was always a goofy guy.
Yeah.
And you were laughing at him, but not in the way that you normally, okay, I'm going to laugh at that person. Like, you were laughing with him at the same time. And to me, that's kind of what llamas are. They're just these goofy, funny animals. But you can't just help but smile when you see them, and there's something about them that are just you just can't not smile when you see them.
Yeah, it's true. Tanner, what about you? How do you describe the personality of a llama?
You know, one of the characters in our film, Greg, kind of described him a little bit, and I'll add on to that. But what he said is they're a lot almost like a cat. In a way, like, they can be a little bit moody at times, and the opposite of a dog. Like, he gives the example, if you kick a dog, it's probably going to come back to you, but a cat necessarily wouldn't do that. And that's the way llamas are. Like, they're actually very intelligent animals that, you know, can sense emotion and feeling from a human. But, I mean, the personality of them can change from llama to llama.
The idea of trust comes up in the film at a number of points. It's about Tracy says they're healing, but you have to earn their trust.
Yeah, like that's exactly how the animal is they absolutely have to trust you, and they're intuitive and they're very intelligent and can pick up on those cues. Just about even the mannerism or characteristics of people, like they'll react differently around different types of people that they've never met before. They can really pick up on vibes. I don't know. I just feel like the goofiness that Aaron talked about with the llamas, that just kind of makes them underestimated and, you know, undercredited.
And I would agree with that. I think from an outward facing, they are really goofy. But one of the things that I found so interesting about doing this documentary, because we went all over the states, and after, you know, a few days of kind of getting to know the people we were interviewing and getting to know their llamas, I felt like for each single one, we would ask them, you know, something, you know, what's the most interesting thing about llamas? And they'd get very kind of reverent for a second, and they would share these very deeply spiritual experiences that they've had with their llamas, where, you know, Tracy talked about how there was someone who came to her ranch that was recently diagnosed with cancer, and with this group of people, and all of the llamas on her ranch were showing this one woman who was recently diagnosed with cancer extreme amounts of affection. And, you know, you hear that once from somebody, especially someone who's very eccentric and very involved with llamas like Tracy. You're like, okay, that's interesting. But it was something that we heard from every single llama person in every single state that we went to, and all different kinds. And to me, that is one of the most interesting things about them, was this sense of spirituality. And Greg even kind of says that he refers to them as God's animal.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, here's another moment from the film. This is Tracy Pearson again talking about how she won't just sell a llama to anyone.
I think the worst things about having llamas here is having to let go of them. That means sell them. How do you do that? Well, you have to look at the person that's inquiring. And you look at their heart. You look at their soul. And if they're really good, they can adopt one. In my own mind, that's the only way that I can justify letting one go. Is it for the price tag on it? Well, that's most helpful, yes, but it's not the reason.
So will you ever just flat out tell somebody
that I don't have any llamas for sale?
Yeah.
Yes. Why? If they don't have it here.
I want to ask you about the idea of history and nature of the llamas is you talk about a bit in the film, and I want to ask you about the kind of the nature of llamas. Are they dangerous? Because that's not the image that comes across at all in the film. And in fact, there's one character, Shannon, in the film who has a llama named Rojo,
mm-hmm.
who's basically a therapy animal. Like, he's not an ideal show animal, but he's just awesome, apparently, with people. So, Tanner, talk a little bit about that, just because I think people could be freaked out a little bit by llamas.
You know, I think a lot of it has to do with people's exposure to llamas previously. I think a lot of times people, the only interaction they've had with a llama is at like a county fair where they're just put behind a fence and moved from city to city, just kind of on show. And those llamas are very different, and I think that's part of where, you know, everybody's like, hey, llama spit. Like, I don't want to get near that thing. It's about to spit on me. And just kind of that interaction's kind of, you know, just disturbed the public's appearance of llamas and them possibly being violent animals. But if you take a llama that's well cared for, it's loved, it's put in a pasture, it's fed, it's groomed, they're almost never violent to humans ever. They do get pretty masculine, like around other llamas for sure. But towards humans, if they're well taken care of, then no, absolutely not.
Aaron, say something about Shannon Joy. I mentioned her just a mm-hmm. second ago, and she has Rojo.
The thing that was so exciting to me about meeting Shannon and especially Rojo was the passion that she had to share the love that she had with her llama, Rojo, with everybody else. Wherever we went, she was just so excited to show off her llama. And, you know, she would put him in a back of a van and, you know, they would just be taking a break, eating hay in the back of the van. And people would be like, can we get a picture? And she's like, yeah, come on over. To me, like, that was something that I thought was so exciting, was to meet somebody who not only had this great passion for llamas, but a passion that they wanted to share with everybody they ran into.
Yeah. It's interesting how many people in the film, and I'm guessing this is true of the culture, I suppose, is they're basically building their lives around llamas. And this brings us to two of the main characters in the film, Janessa Hall and Hunter Snow, these two young women who are pretty good at showing. But talk a little bit about, before we get to the two young ladies, talk about the competition themselves. What's it like to show llamas? Is it like showing dogs?
Absolutely. Like, it's almost exactly the same. It's very, very quiet. It's very long days. I remember the first show we went to, it was like 18 hours long. It was crazy. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, there's usually two or three judges in the arena, and sometimes it's divided into an obstacle course. Sometimes it's a public relations showing category, and your llama's just judged upon those criteria and how well it performs within that criteria. So it's strangely very structured and very disciplined and competitive too.
It's one of those documentaries that almost becomes one of those competition films. You know, you see these, it's kind of a genre in of itself, and there's a bit of that in this film between Janessa, as I mentioned, and Hunter. They're sort of friends, but they're definitely competitors. Aaron, talk a little bit about that relationship, because this is an important part of the film.
Yeah, the relationship between them, it was very interesting to see. especially because we would, you know, see it kind of transpire throughout the year that we were filming the documentary. And to me, it seemed like there was this interesting thing where they were competitors. They were kind of different. And so their personalities clashed. But at the same time, they were going to all these different llama shows. And so they were always seeing each other. They were spending their weekends together. They both shared this love and passion for llamas, which was hard to find.
Yeah.
And this was really their life. And so I think that there was this sense of camaraderie between them that they found in each other that they didn't find in anyone else.
Let's talk about your dad, Tanner. He's a great character in the film. I think one of the best. And let's play a moment from the film. This is Ron Shinnick, Tanner's dad, and how he became, I guess, acquainted with llamas.
I always wanted some llamas, but back in the early 70s, I didn't know where in the world you'd find a llama. So, you know, I just kind of rocked along for years and years. And one day I was watching TV here in Chattanooga and saw a public interest thing about llamas and this guy up on Signal Mountain. And I saw that and I thought, man, I have got to have me some of those things.
But what? What about llamas? Explain that.
You know, like, I don't even know if my dad could tell you what it was at that time.
Yeah.
Absolutely. He was always, and still is, into strange and, I guess, alternative things. We had a pet skunk growing up, parrots, ton of snakes. Like, I was raised on a fish farm. To us, it just kind of seemed normal. And I guess his method of thinking, and I'm sure my mother could back that up too. I mean, she probably thought it was crazy, but it was on brand, as I like to say.
Tracy says in the film that llamas are spiritual too. And she says this. She says they'll teach you to be that way. What does she mean, Tanner, do you think?
Oh, man, that's a deep question. I just think that they give you kind of a different outlook on the world. I think it just gives you better respect for the animal and things that are kind of outside of your understanding, really. They absolutely are spiritual animals and they do have a unique connection to humans. They're kind of a tangent here, but a while ago I was working on a video about a horse therapy company. And kind of their whole idea behind it was doing therapy with horses kind of brings people back to this like prehistoric connection to the animal that we've been missing out on for years. And I think that's also true with llamas. It's just this unexplainable connection that we have no like really rhyme or reason why it's there, but it is there.
That's Tanner Shinnick. He directed the film Llama Nation. He joined us from the studios of NPR member station WABE in Atlanta. Aaron Alsop joined us in the studio. He's the executive producer of the film. On Thursday night, that's this Thursday, April 5th, we're screening Llama Nation at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Aaron and Tanner will be there for a Q&A. We have details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.